So, Mike, do you ever sleep? Seriously?
Michelle, I had a crazy dream last night. I dreamt I was getting ready for this podcast, but I was outside, like on the lawn of a building with an old girlfriend. And I had to set up all my equipment on the lawn outside and find an outlet for power and stuff. And I finally got everything connected and working, and the girlfriend gave me a big long kiss, and then my dream ended.
Wow, that's a good dream. That's really good.
Yeah, so then I think I woke up and texted, what time is a good time to do the podcast?
Hoping to replay that little dream again, maybe. That's really sweet. I like that.
Well, no, not to replay the dream, but just like that it was on my mind, and then it triggered me to think, okay, what time should we do the podcast?
Sure. Sure.
So that podcast is Halt and Catch Fire on West Coast Project number 308, You Are Not Safe. Michelle from Tennessee, what did you think of 308?
Okay. Before I even answer this, I want to just make a couple of, like, prefaces.
It's like the presidential debate.
Yeah, I was actually watching it. Well,
all right, you have 30 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I just want to point out that Halt comes on really late here. It's like comes on at 10 p.m. And I always have to watch it twice. One time with taking notes. So I love the show, but a lot of times it feels like, you know, it's like a have to watch it fast mindset that I'm in because it is so late and we podcast it, you know, the very next morning after it comes on. The show hasn't even been off here, usually 12 hours before you and I are podcasting it. And yesterday was a particularly long, kind of trying day, so my mindset was not where it needed to be when I turned the show on.
Oh,
I was
your like, 30 oh. seconds are up, Michelle.
Okay.
Oh, anyway. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. But this episode, I was absolutely just breathless by the end of it, and it was so late, and I actually got started late watching it. It was so late when I got done with the first time. I was excited to watch it again. They turned everything on its head in this episode. I thought Joe was a good guy and a really likable character, unlike anything I've ever seen in him before. He was actually so likable that I did not trust him until the very end of the episode. The Boz, Donna, Gordon, Diane being wrong on the business and Cameron being right. I love the timeline. They showed us the timeline, which was new, and they don't usually do that in this show, and it was something that you and I have struggled to figure out, and they just laid that out perfectly. I was just stunned at how great this episode was.
Yeah, they made Cameron right, and I don't think I like her being right.
I don't think it's true to form, but... or true life, maybe, but I love how this show took me by surprise. This was some of the best writing and acting I have seen since The Americans, and that is saying something for me.
Well, they've meshed, I think we've said this before, they've meshed the historical growth of technology seamlessly into the hopes and dreams of real people. Or, you know, as real as they can be on television. They've put all that together on top of an accurate history of the technology from those times with real people and their real feelings, and it's just really, really compelling.
On top of probably, you know, it's just like anything that we have and we kind of take for granted now. The all the way back to electricity and telephones and stuff like that. What did it take for these people to achieve this, and how much heartache and mockery and whatever they had to go through. And we just kind of don't even think about that anymore. And I think this is forcing us to think about. And that note that Ryan left, the whole thing, oh my gosh. I mean, it just really, really struck me. And I have to say, it struck me at a time, I mean, you know, by the end of the episode, of course, I was completely sucked in, but I was not as open to this episode as I should have been. And I cannot believe how much it changed my mind on it. I think it was, just like last week, I said might have been their best ever. I think this week topped last week double, at least.
Well, it was a very dark episode for sure. There was very little music. I don't even know if I remember any music in it. Very dark lighting.
Yeah, there was a little. Yeah.
And it was kind of about endings and fleeing things. And they all kind of died a little bit through Ryan dying. And Ryan's note is kind of a warning about the internet that they don't even know yet, that it's all kind of secretly coded into his suicide note.
Right. But we know, we understand what he's saying in that, which just makes it, and I realize that this didn't actually happen, but it just makes it such, like you said, compelling viewing to see this and see that people did have this vision.
How did you like the dates jumping around? They did like December 19th, 1986, and then they jumped to 4 months earlier, and then they had got a little bit jump into the future a couple more times, and they ended up on December 18th. And I guess ultimately the past the time that Ryan killed himself.
Okay, I don't remember them jumping back and forth. I did know that they start. I mean, of course they did. They started on December 18th, and then I thought they just took us back 4 months and then played out those 4 months. But I could be wrong.
No, they jumped into October because they were talking about Halloween, and then they jumped to Christmas.
Right, but they didn't jump like back and forth in those 4 months. I thought they just started in December, went back to probably, what, September or August, and then just kind of progressed through.
Because yeah, then they didn't go forward and backward. They jumped backward and then three more times just forward.
Right. I loved it. I loved that. I was so glad that they showed us the dates. And it's not 1987, like we said last time. It's still 1986.
So on December 19th, 1986, I looked up Take Me Back, too, and some stuff just to see what was going on then, Michelle.
Oh,
so
fun.
December 19th was a Friday. The president was Ronald Reagan. Walk Like an Egyptian was the big hit song by the Bangles.
Absolutely.
And the UK song was The Final Countdown. Some of the movies were Little Shop of Horrors, Platoon, The Golden Child with Eddie Murphy, The Three Amigos.
That's fun stuff.
The TV series, Crime Story, Zubily Zoo.
I don't know that one.
Siskel and Ebert. So pretty fun.
That's really fun. Yeah, that's a good thing to do. That's interesting. Kind of takes us back. Yeah.
Mikhail Gorbachev released Andrei Sakharov and his wife from exile. Anyway, pretty cool.
Yeah. I like that.
So there were contradictions in this. Joe's considerate now, worried about his friend Ryan, and Gordon seems a little childish, but then he kind of matured too. Like, but he does kind of leave with, I thought I was your friend. Kind of childish, I thought. And Cameron's a domicile now. She's the Halloween mom handing out candy.
Yeah. And still, you know, almost like going back, creating. And we saw that a lot. Joe talks about, I can't answer that question anymore. I can't. You know, what's next? I can't do this anymore. I'm done. Cameron going back to you know, just sitting by herself and creating video games. And the house is even reminiscent of the house that she was in. I think we talked about that before, too, the house she was in with Joe when all this was going on, kind of. And I think we saw a lot of going back. Donna was a tragic tragic figure to me in this. Gordon annoyed me, and then I felt for him. I still don't know how I feel about Gordon. I'm leaning toward your vision of Tom and Cameron, and we'll talk about that a little bit when we get there. That was pretty sad.
It seems like the women are so much happier without the men around them in this series. Like, Donna just exults in her hotel room, free from Gordon and the kids. She's just, like, free, and, like, she's having breakfast, and it's a nice hotel, so that part helps. But she's just free, and she can breathe. And then when Tom leaves for the work for the day, Cameron rolls over, and she just breathes. She exhales, like, oh, I'm free. I'm by myself again. I don't know. I see them, if there is any kind of a future for this show, that they got to kind of be free from those two dudes. Tom and Gordon free. They have to be freed from Tom and Gordon to be fully fulfilled, I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure what direction this will go in, but we were, and I don't know if I don't know that I disagree with that anymore. I don't think Gordon's going to go anywhere. I think he'll still be on the show. I think he's pretty ingrained in it at this point, at least for a while. Unless, of course, they write him off for his illness. And Tom is a tragic character to me. But I see Donna with a lot of regret in this episode. But there again, we'll talk about it when we get to that scene. It was just a great scene.
This show is always more interesting to talk about in the general themes of what's going on than the recaps of the scene by scene. But
I agree.
Let's go through the scene by scene just to help us remember some more of those themes.
Okay.
So it starts out that day, December 19th, 1986. Joe is thinking, and of course we know what he's thinking about because we know the ending now, but it doesn't show us really what he's thinking about. He's just in his apartment considering all that just happened. Then we get the time stamp 4 months earlier, and we go back to 4 months where the FBI is after Ryan, and they're going after him with some pretty elegant recovery devices, Michelle, packet sniffers.
Yeah.
And
I actually meant to look that up. Do you know what that is? I've never heard of that before. It was plugged into the telephone line.
Just knows, I guess, what and when packets of data were sent through. It's interesting that the FBI guy says, that's what I thought, that's what I thought when they caught me. So that he was a hacker that got caught and then hired by the FBI.
Yeah.
And so Ryan looks pretty worried and ends up taking off and going on the run.
I would be a little surprised if Ryan didn't know about that, though. Wouldn't you?
No.
No?
No, it's okay. All new. Everything's new every day, every technology day.
Yeah, but it's not that new, because this guy who said that, that's kind of what I'm saying. The guy who was plugging it in, the guy who's working with or for or whatever the FBI said, that's what I thought, too, until, I was caught. And so that happened a while ago.
Yeah, but think of the hackers in the FBI. The FBI has hackers on steroids. They have all the money and resources to give them all these new tools. Like, here's money, develop something that can, help you figure out how to hack into this crime.
Well,
I bet it's, I mean, just think of the stuff the FBI has now that we don't know about.
That's a good point.
But it sends Ryan pretty out. He thought he had everything covered by throwing some lighter fluid on his drive and throwing a pack of matches on it, but doesn't look like that's the case.
Well, no, and Joe knew, kind of, or at least was intuitive about, he said, you're not that good. And I don't know that he knew specifically, they didn't give us any indication of that, but he knew that there were things, I guess, that they were capable of doing.
Well, he's also a rookie. He's a young guy just getting into this, and he thinks that's the fault of most young people, is they think they're immortal and they make no mistakes. And, he's just a rookie, and he's gonna not know what he's up against, really. And he's a protege of Joe, and Joe's kind of teaching him, like, you're going to learn. You don't know everything. In fact, that's interesting at the end how Joe cuts off his own protege because he can't work with Joe McMillan anymore. But that takes us right up to the credits, and we come back to Joe's apartment, and Gordon and Joe are talking. The FBI guys are looking for Ryan. Joe tells Gordon that he had nothing to do with the leak and has to kind of look him in the eyes to make him believe it. And Gordon does finally believe him.
Yeah. And what did you think about that? What did you think about how willing to believe him Gordon was?
I think Gordon's making a pretty quick change of character, which may be a little unbelievable, but it's more makes him way more likable that these guys can be friends.
Too. Yeah.
I mean, I believe that Gordon would believe him because Joe seems sincere.
Joe does seem sincere, and I'm kind of wondering if Gordon doesn't have some kind of insight with Joe. But we have to remember that this just happened at this point. I mean, not very far in the past at all, that he was suing him and suing his company, and it was like a big deal thing and total mistrust, and Joe was being Joe. So this came about pretty quickly, but you're right. It does make Gordon more likable. He tells Joe to look him in the eye and tell him, and Joe does, and he just says, okay, then we're in this together. I'm all in.
Well, Gordon had also just offered Joe 49% of his company because he needs him. We know he needs him. He can't do this without Joe helping him, so he needs him. He needs to kind of mend ways with him.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point, too.
So when they get the new timestamp jumping ahead to October 1986, Donna's practicing for the shareholders meeting or the IPO, the announcement of the IPO with Boz and Diane. And Michelle, they're doing exactly what Cameron feared. They're not working on the nuts and bolts of running the company. They're only worried about bolstering their story and their stock price. And Diane even says everybody hates this process. It's exactly what Cameron told them would happen.
Yeah, and this whole scene, now, this was pretty interesting to me. This started, it was in October. We know that it goes public in December. So they were traveling this whole time, it looked like. They never showed them back at home or back at Mutiny or anything. And that's a really long time to just be doing this. Also, this scene with Boz. What was going on with Boz in this scene? He was like bitter toward Donna. Everything Donna did. I mean, maybe he was just being honest, but he was not being very nice with his honesty.
Boz and, Boz and Gordon are on Team Cameron, and they kind of went along with everybody else.
Okay, but come on. Yeah, you don't get to do that. Nobody forced Boz's hand in any way, but then he's going to turn around and be bitter toward Donna. And he even brought that up, I think. He's like, you know, well, it was like a forced vote or something. And she's like, I mean, and it wasn't. It wasn't a forced vote on his part. Gordon, okay. But Boz, I completely disagree with. Boz was doing what he felt like was in the best interest of the company. Boz, Diane, Donna, and probably even Gordon. So I don't like how he turns this on her.
I think Boz is the voice of, like, morality, too. It's because he says, it sounds like you're eulogizing the family dog. Like, you don't mean it. And she's right. She's given these platitudes about how Cameron's this great founder, but she doesn't really mean it. She's just saying it to sound good. And then she gets all angry, and she sounds real then, and he says, now you sound real. He's just the voice of, you know, he's the ear. He's got a very tuned-in ear to what's really happening, and he verbalizes it.
Well, yeah, he does do that. He does. I was just surprised at his kind of venom toward Donna in this. And I wonder if he's maybe, well, I mean, he even says the crowd last night wasn't good. And she's like, I mean, here she is practicing and he's telling her this. And so it's like messing her up. And she's giving him this look. And he's like, look, I just call it like I see it. So maybe it's,
you know, I'm going to say this about Donna. I think Donna is upset because of what happened to Cameron, not because that she tried this and failed. And now she needs help from other people because she failed. I think she's genuinely upset about what happened between her and Cameron.
I think there's a lot that goes on.
You pointed that out in her dream with the mushrooms laying on the lawn. She was laying in the grass. And she was thinking about Cameron and how it went wrong. She had no motivation to do that. That's just really how she really felt.
But, yeah, yes, and I agree. I think there's a whole lot more to it than that. I feel like Donna feels like she gave up everything for this and for this idea, and she kind of has. I mean, everything. But she had to do this, right? I mean, you agreed. Everybody that I have even talked to about this agreed that it was the right thing to do. To make this move.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes everybody's right and everybody's wrong at the same time. Maybe sure. The world just wasn't ready for an internet company. You know, nobody knows what the hell it is. They say later on there are only 25 million computers. It sounds like a lot, but think of how many computers there are now. How many computers are in your house?
Yeah, a bunch.
I'm a single guy and I have three. I can count right away. Probably have a couple more somewhere in storage. Or, you know, there's 25 million computers in the whole probably country, but probably world. There aren't that many people that are into this yet. And we see that idiot TV business lady doesn't even know what she's asking questions about later on.
Yeah, I think that was part of the problem with the whole interview and with the stocks and everything. I think that had a lot to do with it too. And I think you're right. But so what are we saying? Because Donna was such a visionary of what was to come and she just hit it too soon.
Yeah. It was just, okay. There probably were IPOs in 1987 and 86 and 85 about these types of products that just fell flat on their face. Just their time. Okay. You know, IPOs just mean people making decisions to buy stock.
Right.
People, individual people making decisions. And internet, you know, am I going to put my credit card onto some guy that has some wireless transfer thing? Hell no. I'm not getting wrapped up in that.
Right.
I remember worrying about using my credit card when you could buy gas at gas pumps with it. Like, is it really that good idea to use your credit card here?
Yeah, I get that. I've got some questions about that when we get there, though. There's some things I don't understand about the business side of it that I'd like to talk to you about.
All right, well, next scene is Cameron and Tom in their marital bed. Very surreal scenes between Cameron and Tom, I thought. Tom is just too perfect for her. He's got the perfect answer, like, oh, I need you to do this, pick this up. And he's loving, and he's too perfect for her.
Yeah, and it's fun stuff. Go buy candy. I mean, he's not saying, hey, you know, the oil needs to, I don't know. You know, it's fun stuff, and he's encouraging and telling her, you need to get out of the house. Come on, you know, let's do some stuff. And we also find out that he has just started this job right here. He says he has to wait to at least the second week to start going in late. So we're kind of getting a timeline on him and what he's been doing and how long it took him to get a job and all that, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, he's going into his work, and her job is to watch Evil Dead all day.
Well, $25,000 pyramid, too, though. That's important. And eating Life cereal out of a box. There was a lot of product placement in this, I thought. A lot of older product placements. Pretty interesting.
This is the scene where I just described Cameron being alone and kind of loving it. Tom leaves, and the shot lingers on her being alone for multiple seconds. And, you know, it's not like minutes, but it's like a long time that she's in bed. She rolls back over and she makes that big exhale, mm-hmm. almost like the weight of Tom has left her and she's kind of free and on her own.
Right.
It's my interpretation, but I think that's sort of a message there. Then she's haunted by wasps. That's a great repellent for kids on your Halloween porch. Nice big wasp nest.
Yeah. So wasn't that interesting? Wasn't that whole wasp thing interesting to the whole totality of this episode?
Something she shares with Joe, the fascination with the wasp nest. And it's also a fascinating thing in that it's kind of dangerous and kind of like unpleasant. She looks at that wasp on the TV screen like it's a butterfly. Like, oh, this is interesting. She's not afraid of it, and she's not swatting at it. She just kind of follows it like with curiosity.
Right. And she takes down the wasp nest to keep the children safe. Cameron is the one who is protecting in this episode, this you're not safe episode. And I just thought that was a real interesting change for her, considering.
Yeah, she's the domicile, like I said, and Donna's the one happy to be alone in the hotel room. I don't know. It is an interesting flip. So is this guy Mitch, Gordon's lawyer? Is that Mitch?
Yes.
Mitch and Gordon play Ryan's phone tape for Joe, and they say they can't work with Ryan. He's too toxic.
So, oh, no. I'm sorry. Mitch is the guy that they're doing the NSF thing with, I think.
Okay. He's not the lawyer. He's not Gordon's lawyer.
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure Mitch is the guy, the sharp dresser they were talking about before, I think. That's who I thought he was anyway.
So they can't work with Ryan. So the contract's frozen until they figure out what happens next with Ryan.
Right.
And Joe doesn't want to freeze Ryan out because he's my friend. So we're starting to get this. We're starting to be asked to believe that Joe has the ability to make real friends with people.
Right.
And here's where Gordon says, I thought I was your friend. Kind of childish. Yeah.
Well, and he also asks him, he says, so, Joe, how did Ryan know all this? Kind of like he doesn't really trust Joe at this point. And Joe's like, I guess he's reading our emails. He built the system. He knows how to get into it. So we're still seeing some distrust. But as soon as Joe explains it again, kind of defends himself, Gordon is really quick to go, okay.
Yeah, we got to believe Joe's really changing here, because if this is all just another act, this is like a really tired act from Joe.
I was really afraid. I didn't trust him at all, which is, I guess, what I'm kind of projecting on Gordon, because I didn't understand how Gordon could trust him so quickly. Even though he needed him and needed to trust him, I didn't see how he could, because I didn't. I really thought this whole time Joe had something sinister going on.
Yeah, I think he nails it down that he's changed when he makes Gordon sit down and tell him about his health, though. That is that's too much to believe that's part of all a big act, too. So that kind of hammers it home that he's really kind of changing.
Well, and I also think it goes back to Joe's health scare that he had just a while ago, because he realized how scary that was. And so when Gordon said it, he didn't know what he was talking about.
So the trick-or-treaters interrupt Cameron's Evil Dead Fest. And her only shitty candy, Michelle, is Good and Plenty.
Yep.
And Joe shows up, and she says, oh, it's a tall child dressed as Joe McMillan. And she just beams with him around her. She just lights up and comes alive.
She comes alive around him, and he kind of comes alive as much as possible around her. But she comes alive around Joe the way Tom comes alive around her, which is so incredibly sad to me.
Well, it's the way people are.
Yeah.
You can't pick and choose who you come alive around.
No, I guess you can't.
Joe's dressed just like the criminal from The Breakfast Club, the guy Judd Nelson played with the pea coat.
Is he
looks
really?
Exactly like him, yeah.
I did not notice that.
He's the guy who's in the detention for pulling the false fire alarms.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which would have been right around that time. I think that movie came out around that time. Anyway, Joe's looking for help finding Ryan and gets around not only telling her what he needs her to help him with, but just starts to ask her, how are you? Which Joe never asks people. How are you? By the way, how are you? Gordon told me about, I guess, the stock and the company and the being outed and all that. And he says, I'm working with him now. And Joe shifts gears a few times pretty quickly in the scene with Cameron. He's walking around her little living room there, and he sees the pictures of Tom and Cameron.
Right.
Or Tom on it might be Tom's a Polaroid or something. Cameron looks really disappointed, like, oh, shit, Tom's going to interrupt this now. You know, I don't want Tom involved in this little interlude with Joe. I don't know. I'm reading a lot into this, but I think that's what I'm reading.
Yeah. Well, she even points out, Joe says that he's lucky, and Cameron says, I think I'm just making him miserable, which is kind of a really personal, intimate thing for her to be talking about with Joe, considering she's this very, very newlywed. Also, we see Joe, it seems super important to him that he knows that he's trying to help Ryan and that he didn't tell him to do this. Cameron kind of makes some little offhanded comment to him, and he's like, look, I didn't want him to do this. I mean, and it seemed really important to him that Cameron believed this. So there was a lot of intimate moments in this, even before the bonding over the wasp nest.
Yeah, that was a super intimate moment. Like, he was just waiting for them to lean over and kiss him. Maybe that had something to do with my dream, because I was like, it was kind of like that. Like, there was no like, oh, I can't, I'm just horny and I want to kiss somebody. It was like an intimate moment, like not even sexual. It was like a just being close to somebody, and you were just waiting for them to do that with this wasp nest.
Yeah, yeah. Those two are like magnets, and when they get so close to one another, it's like they just it's like there's a force that pulls them in together, and I think they play that part just perfectly because I feel it when they're doing that.
So the next scene, Donna calls home to the fleeting kids and Gordon. None of them really want to talk to her. One kid has a spear. I don't know what her costume really was, but she has to say it's a wand or something, not a spear.
Yeah.
A stick. And Joni is Joan Montana, which is pretty clever, I thought, being in San Francisco. Joe Montana, the quarterback.
Right.
And Donna says, I miss you. And Gordon says, I miss you too. And just hangs up on her.
Yeah. The girls are very dismissive. Joni doesn't want to talk to her mom when her mom wants to talk to her. Donna is missing these kids on Halloween. And she turns around to Gordon, and she's like, Gordon, I miss you. I really miss you. And he's like, yeah, me too, bye. And hangs up the phone. Very unlikable as far as that kind of thing goes. I think Donna is still, you know, you're seeing her as having fun and enjoying her time. And I think she is, because I think she feels like she's doing the right thing and she's making a good move. I see her as this mom and wife who realizes everything she's missing at home when she's not there to braid Joni's hair, and that her family's going on without her. And I can, like, feel the pain that she's going through with that situation. I mean, it's Halloween. You want to be with your kids, and they only get so many little kid Halloweens. It's very few where they dress up and have fun, and she's gone. I don't know. I thought that was... I really disliked how Gordon was there.
I actually thought about Gordon from this scene, too. Like I almost wish I had the wisdom that I can see Gordon with in this show. I wish I had that wisdom back when I was, you know, first old enough to date people and get in relationships. Like, for all the girls I ever disappointed, Gordon's really disappointing Donna here. Like, she needs him now. She really needs him, and he's just vacant to her. And he could be really helpful to her, but he's not. He's just dismissive of her.
Yeah.
And yeah. I wish, it made me think, like, I wish the other characters that they could get over some of their most, I don't know, some of the most common human pitfalls that we have, the resentments that nag at us. Like, as third-party viewers of this show, it seems irritating. Like, oh, he should be nicer to her. But as the primary participant, it's really powerful. Like, for Donna, that was really powerful to be hung up upon when all he had to do was talk to her a little bit.
Right. It's like the pettiness of life that they're allowing to really impact their whole relationships and probably the future outcomes of these relationships.
I wonder how often I still do that. Like, I just miss the cues from people. Like, hey, I really kind of need you to listen to me, and you could help me by being more attentive to hearing what I have to say. I don't know. I think a lot of people don't even think about that. They just bumble their way through life like Gordon does there. Oh, got to finish braiding the hair here. Talk to you later. He doesn't catch the cue that she's kind of lost now.
Right. Take 60 seconds, Gordon. 60 seconds and make a difference to this person that you've pledged your life to. That's a great point, Mike.
So Cameron is Alf now on the IRC. What the hell is Alf doing coming back on so many television shows, Michelle?
I'm not sure. I never watched Alf even back then. I didn't either. I don't know.
Alf was one of the costumes of the kids coming to the door at Cameron's house.
Mm-hmm.
Alf was a big part of Mr. Robot.
Yeah.
I don't know what Alf is, why the big thing with Alf, but Cameron's screen name or code name is Alf on the IRC. And she puts out the question, Joe McMillan, hero or hoax? With no.
Is that what she was on? Was it IRC?
Because I think so. It was the chat room, the mutiny chat.
Okay. Because it was, are you safe? And I thought that was interesting that that was the name of the room right there. It's like, okay.
Well, that was Ryan's diatribe. Right. He put it on the same place.
Oh, okay.
He put it on the Mutiny
okay.
chat room. That's why they all were reading it at Mutiny.
Okay, that makes more sense.
It's a public suicide note. anyway, the Joe McMillan hero or hoax gets no responses. She just stares at the screen. There's like it's a mystery.
Right.
So then we jump to a new date, another date, December 18th, 1986, at Gordon's house. Joe and Gordon are talking.
It's December 18th here?
Yeah.
It's the last? Oh, the day before. Okay.
Yeah, they show a new date. Joe's still, we're still buying into Joe's new character. He still seems out of character because I'm still waiting for the old Joe to reappear. There's no sign
me
of,
too.
Still no
me
sign
too.
Of Ryan.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but let me go back to the scene where Joe is talking to Cameron and he's trying to convince her that he's trying to find Ryan. He only wants to help him. I actually wrote the words, oh no, in my notes. I thought Joe was going to, at this point, I just have no trust for him. And I thought he was going to get Cameron to go find Ryan and then he was going to turn him in so they could go ahead with this project. And I couldn't really see him doing that. But at the same time, I worried that he was going to do that.
Well, so, Cameron asked that. Is that why you want to find him, to turn him in?
Right. But Joe convinces her that that's not it. And I was so scared that that was going to be exactly it. And just like another, you know, gut punch to Cameron once she maybe found him.
Well, it would have been better if you got turned in. Wouldn't it be splattered on the streets of San Francisco? Anyway, so December 18th, this is where Gordon asks about Ryan and Joe being lovers, or tries to. I don't think he ever gets the words out.
Yeah, that was kind of an awkward question. You know.
Were you and Ryan, you know?
You know, yeah. And Joe kind of messes with him a little bit there, which was kind of funny.
So Joe says, I think you should move forward with NSFNet alone without me. And Gordon says, I can't do it alone. I'm sick. And Joe makes him stay and tell him the details, but not us the details, Michelle. This scene cuts away.
Right.
The guy was smart not to know exactly what's going on with Gordon. Gives the writers more freedom, too, to make whatever they want to make of Gordon later on if they have time to make something of him later on.
Yeah, right. And I'm kind of wondering here if maybe something hasn't progressed. Like you said from the get-go, and I've been kind of hesitant toward thinking it was more psychosomatic, but I'm wondering if things haven't progressed here because he didn't mind doing Clark Computers, knowing this stuff and everything. So I'm wondering now if maybe something's progressing, like he's got medical, you know.
I don't know why this is so hard to believe, but I seriously think Gordon all along has been progressively physically getting more ill and dying. And that's his interesting angle. That's his role to play in the series.
Yeah, I just never took that. I took it as it was much more psychosomatic and it was more leaning toward his. And they did throw that in there a lot. I mean, I didn't just make this up, but I guess that it maybe is much more physical. I don't know why they would have put that in there, that it always happened in times of stress, and show us all the other stuff and have the doctors even saying, no, nothing's progressed after the terrible time in the parking garage and everything, and putting the bug in Donna's ear that, you know, maybe he needs to talk to us, psychiatrist maybe or something. I don't know.
I mean, he could be sick, like having early onset Alzheimer's or something where his mind is going, but that's still even a physical that you die of that, right? You don't just...
Yeah, but that's not what they were saying, though. That's not what they were saying, and that's not what they were leaning toward. They were leaning toward, you know, did he show signs of things before? And then they kind of would go back and stuff. Like, this was definitely... that they were showing us that he had some kind of mental illness combined with this. And I'm just not real sure why they wanted to put that together, unless they wanted us maybe to not know which way.
Yeah, I don't know. It's some sort of a brain thing, because it's like the solder, the vape, the toxic vapor from the solder got to his brain. Maybe right. That makes him psychosomatic, but it seems physical to me.
Yeah, I definitely got more of that in this episode, and I'm wondering what kind of, you know, medical diagnosis he's progressed in now.
And
that
it's
they didn't
serious.
Show
it. You don't have a scene where Joe makes him sit down and tell him the details, and he says, oh, yeah, sometimes I have a fainting spell. It's got to be more serious. It's
right.
Got to be life.
I think you're right.
Life-ending, life-threatening. So Cameron finds Ryan through the IRC port on Mutiny, and he's gone back. He's had a little bit of an adventure. He's actually gone back to San Francisco via San Diego. He spent some time in Southern California, and he's in some student's lounge where they have coffee and computers and can blend right in. The two things he needs. And Cameron tells him, Joe wants to help you and I want to help you. And she puts Joe in a great light, just paints Joe in a great light, and tells Ryan to go to him and review any options he might still have.
Yeah, and what about how Ryan seemed in this scene? Speaking of what we were just talking about with Gordon, he is paranoid, right? He's afraid his cousin's going to turn him in when he was down there. And I mean, maybe he was, but he's talking about people following him, and maybe they were, but he seems really not okay.
Yeah, he's miserable. They got to make him miserable to, like, eliminate all of his choices.
Yeah,
he has very few options, you know, and he's making bad judgments that, oh, 5 years, that's forever. I can't do that. You know, that's from a 22-year-old kid or whatever. He's young. He could easily probably do that.
But anyway. You still see what's mainly on his mind, right? Because underneath all that, when he digs deep and he's sitting there and he's talking, what really comes out, the main thing is he says that Joe probably hates him now. And it was like that was like the crux of everything to him.
Yeah, well, that's the final nail in his coffin is, okay, I'll go to jail, I'll do the 5 years, and then we'll work together. And like, no, I can't ever work with you. So that was the final thing that he wanted. So go back to a new scene with Boz and Gordon. Looks like they're in the Mutiny server room or something. And they're drinking that whiskey, Michelle. I tried to look at the bottle to see what whiskey Boz likes. Did you catch that?
I didn't.
I thought it was maybe Southern Comfort, because when they were pouring the bottle, you could really briefly see it. But I think it's Wild Turkey.
Oh, wow.
Which seems perfect for Boz's bourbon. And Boz says it's the eve of that big day. The IPO is coming up. And they expect it to open at $15. And they start spending their money. Interestingly, later on, they admonish some kid at the Mutiny shop for thinking about spending money on a sailboat.
Yeah,
but they're spending their money here too. And Gordon asks, have you talked to Cameron? Bosworth says, no, have you? And Gordon says, nope, but she'll be a millionaire tomorrow, can't be too sorry about that. So even if she's forced out, she stands to be in line to make a big payday from this IPO, they think, at least.
Right. And that's kind of like my point, I guess, is that Boz, while he was being so harsh with Donna, this is his idea, too. He really has faith and belief in this. This was not just my hand was forced. And even Gordon believes it, as evidenced by the stuff they're talking about here.
Yeah, but Boz didn't like the shit going on behind her back. The angling to make these plays and moves behind her back without her knowing.
No, absolutely. But they all felt like it was in her best interest, even though it wasn't handled well.
Well, it's in the company's best interest, which I guess by proxy is in her best interest. But, if she didn't want to do it, is it still in her best interest? Her best interest was to keep things her way. It's an opinion, I guess. Is it her best interest if she hates it?
If she moved everybody all the way or halfway across the country because that was her vision to grow this thing, then it was, in my opinion, definitely in her best interest to allow this to grow, as everyone saw that it was going to grow. She was the one standing in her own way. It's just like you said, I'm really surprised that they turned it in that direction, and I'm not really sure about it. But
what if the company is a $100,000 company and it's an arty little, successful little small company, and Cameron's doing everything she loves and likes, and nobody's rich, nobody has any money, it's all kind of just day to day, but she's happy and she's creative and she's like arty. That would seem to me to be in Cameron's best interest and not the company's best interest. I think they can be two different things.
Absolutely, and I think you're right. I just think once you move a plane full of people across the country to do something, that then it's bigger than you.
Yeah, but that's still her. She's got her own personal view of what's in her best interest. I think that's why Gordon makes this statement that she'll be a millionaire tomorrow. At least that's consolation for her. She can't be too sorry about that. It's like almost as nice for her that she's going to be a millionaire, even though that's not really what she's after. It's like a consolation prize, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very conflicted about this and about the way it went. So,
all right. So go to Cameron and Tom's house. She greets him coming home from work now, and she shows him the space girl. That's clearly herself riding on the motorcycle and striving to get the greatest gift of all, common sense.
Yep.
And Tom asks her, how do you win? And Cameron says, you don't. You just get to keep playing.
Yep.
I think that's her philosophy. It's like, there is no need for a prize. You get to just keep playing. You get to keep doing what you want to do. And that's Cameron's. That's her winning.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I think this scene also showed us that, Tom comes in, he says, do you want to hear a proposition? And she doesn't. She doesn't want to hear it. She wants him to see her thing. She's interested in what she's doing. And he has to even ask her again. She doesn't even remember once she's told him the whole thing. Oh, by the way, what was the proposition? She doesn't even remember. She's just very wrapped up in Cameron.
Well, that's the whole point of everything we just talked about, right? That's why it doesn't matter to her that she moved 12 people across country to a new, whole new gig. It's like her. Anyway, so Tom's job is going to go to Japan. And I thought Cameron's thinking, that's perfect. You go away and I create seismic change here in California. See you later, dude. Because she does literally say that's perfect, although she doesn't clarify exactly how it's perfect. But, they make it look like she's, of course, going away with him. But that's how I took it, that somehow he's going to now go to Tokyo and she's going to find a way to stay in California.
Oh, you thought at that point that was what that was about?
I still think that. That's perfect. I'm free of you. You go away. You excel. You reach your success. And I stay here and create change in California.
Okay, I don't know if that's what's going to happen or not, but I don't think that's what she was feeling then in her impulsiveness. I think she was just ready to get away from where she was.
Well, that's a perfectly good interpretation, and that makes a lot of sense. But I also think that there's this other secret meaning to that. Oh, that's perfect. Because now I have a reason to have you go away, and I'm free again to do whatever I want to do. Remember, you just said it, Michelle. She's more interested in showing him the motorcycle girl than to listening to his big move that he has to share with her.
Yeah. Yeah, anyway. that's interesting, but I don't think she is feeling that at this point. I don't know what's going to happen, but I really feel like when he says this and she looks at him, it takes her, like, what, 2 seconds to come up with, that's perfect, I can get out of here.
Yeah, but now, see, that proves both like your point and my point, that if it, whichever way it ends up being, it's an interesting answer. It's an interesting statement for her to make.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, they could do this. If this thing ends in 2 episodes, they could have an epilogue and just say Cameron Howell became the president of XYZ in Silicon Valley while Tom went on to be, you know, whatever, the procurement officer for XYZ in Tokyo. They could easily put it either way, or they could be married and happy in Tokyo together. It's a very interesting option that they have. All right, so go back to Joe and Ryan now. Ryan does go to Joe and talk to him and tells him he feels cut out for what he created. I put the code out there, defended your name. And Joe tells him, I was worried about you. And then tells him the huge price, according to, well, at least in Ryan's mind, the huge price he has to pay. It's 5 years of no computer after you go to jail for a year or two. Or run away. And Joe says, if you run or you stay, either way, I'll help you. And if you disappear, the network disappears too. So Joe's going to kill this thing if Ryan runs.
Yeah, and he even offers him $50,000 and a ride to the bus station. I mean, he gives him like a sincere, right, offer either way.
Yeah, I think he's sincere either way. It's up to Ryan. But Ryan says, no, I don't want that. It's an impossible choice. And Joe tells him that he can't ever work with him again. And Ryan says, but you would do it this way. It's the classic Joe McMillan. And Joe says, I can't work with Joe McMillan anymore.
Yeah, and Ryan's right. He's right about that. That it is a classic Joe McMillan move. I'll put this in a box over here on the side, and I'll come back to that just as soon as I'm allowed to do that.
Right, because Ryan has become Joe McMillan Jr., Joe McMillan Apprentice. And that's why Joe can't work with him, because he can't work with people like that anymore in his new venture with Gordon. All right, so Donna at the hotel. Diane pumps her up right before the talk to the TV reporter. Says, you're going to be great. And Gordon and the kids get ready to go down and watch her on, I guess it's early morning, super early morning television, news TV.
Yeah, it's still dark out.
By the way, Michelle, the daughters are recast. It's two new girls, I think.
They
look different from the old Joni and Chachi, or whatever the other one's name is.
Haley. Yeah. Probably not Chachi. That's cute, though.
Donna tries to give some credit to Cameron as she's talking to the TV reporter as the OG founder. She's the original founder. And the TV reporter mistakenly thinks Cameron is a man. And then she's dopily impressed that it's a woman. That TV reporter was a freaking clown. She's just vapid.
Yeah, and I think that had... Okay. That seemed to have a real impact on the public view, because this was like a big deal, right? This was a big deal. This was them explaining their product to the public. And this one kind of ditzy reporter, journalist, whatever she was, news person, seemed to just demolish it just in one little, what, 5-minute interview or something.
1 minute.
Oh, so I can buy shoes.
She's a business reporter, too. She wasn't just like the entertainment, you know, or the anchor. She was the business. She specialized in businesses and financial IPOs.
Yeah, that's insulting then, because that was nothing.
But it's brilliant, because it does reflect, like I said, only 25 million people had computers.
Okay, but still, that's not a business person who's up there
She's a dope for sure.
Yeah.
But I think it says the message. It doesn't matter how perfect they could have made Mutiny. Like, even Cameron made them wait, and they made it perfect. The dopey reporter still would have said, can I buy shoes with it? The time was still wrong.
Right. That's what I was going to say. If they had waited with this kind of site that we have now, if they had waited, the public would have been more ready for this product.
Yeah,
maybe.
It didn't really matter how many other platforms on computers it could have worked on. The public just wasn't ready for it. The public, right. The lady who's a dope reporter asked the same thing the public would have asked. Yeah, a good question. Can I buy shoes with it? What the hell is it? We were all ignorant back then of what the internet was.
Well, sure. And I think we're also seeing how one little twist in something can take something from really great and big to just like crashing down.
Well, it was never really great and big. We see it that way because we know from our future perspective how big it is. Then it wasn't. It was just a couple colleges linked together by a cable. What the hell? Who cares?
Yeah, but it is. I mean, CompuServe saw it as that. People in the know definitely saw it as that. And if this reporter had a different interaction with Donna, then the whole public might have seen it like that.
Yeah, but of the whole public of three, I don't know how many people the population was in 1986, but only 25 million even had a computer. The whole public didn't rush out to buy every household had a computer. Not yet.
Right.
Just not yet. So back in Mutiny, they've intercepted some bank phone line so they can watch the stock prices of the IPO coming out that day. And Boz admonishes
them. It's kind of funny because we can find that on several channels now. At any time of day, you can see the stock ticker. And back then, you couldn't. So
yeah, they were literally plugging in a phone, telephone wire, a cable into their computer to intercept it. And Boz just kind of laughs it off like, oh, I had nothing to do with this. And then he makes a statement to the mutiny worker for looking at the sailboats. Don't spend your money before you earn it, even though he and Gordon had just done that.
Right.
And they watched the stock price, Michelle. And Donna and Diane, it's interesting how they showed a few different people looking at the stock price. Donna and Diane do the same on a computer. Comes out at 8. Not 15, comes out at 8, and then drops to 6. And interesting on Donna and Diane, Donna has to refresh manually. She has to hit the key to refresh it. It's not like a streaming.
Right.
And then Gordon and the girls are watching it, and it goes down from 6 to 5. And then Tom and Cameron are watching it apart. They're interestingly very far apart in that room. Cameron can't watch. Tom's watching it. And he asks her if she wants to know what it is. And I couldn't read what it was on Tom's computer, but might have still been at 5. And then we go back to Diane and Donna. And Diane says, it doesn't mean the stock is worthless. Even Commodore had a horrible quarter. So, Michelle, all this means, really, it came out at 5. I mean, it wasn't 16 or 15. So it's a third. It's a value of a third of what they thought. All this means is they have more work to do. It just means work, more work.
Well, did it end at 5?
Well,
I mean,
we don't know
how far down did it go? Right. That's just it. We don't know. And that's what I was going to ask you, actually, because I don't know a whole lot about this kind of thing. And I was wondering, what is the starting point? How does that work? I mean, can you give me some kind of really quick crash course in that? I mean, a company thinks it's going to be a certain amount, and what?
Yeah, they have a market maker say, we think this this initial offering, the value of this company, because they have $600,000 worth of computers, and they have a product that we think can sell to X amount of customers. Sorry.
Okay.
Thought I'd put that on hold. So we have X amount of inventory, we have X amount of capital goods like computers and hardware, and we have an idea that we can sell to X amount of customers, so it's worth this, and people will buy into our stock. So some people might buy in at 8, and then they realize not enough people are buying in, so they sell it right away, like, ooh, 8 was a bad decision, I'm selling, I'll take what I can get for it. They get 6, more people sell, it goes down to 5. And you're right, we didn't see the final closing price that day or the days after, but it's now public. It can be traded. And if people don't think it's worth 5, they're going to sell it. And if people think 5's a great value, they're going to buy it. It's just supply and demand.
Okay. Okay, because I wasn't sure how it started, like, at 15. Like, I didn't know what made them think it was going to start at 15. That was just, like, a projection on their part, correct?
Yeah, it's always a guess.
Okay.
But it's an educated guess, because some market makers say, we think this is worth 12. And if you're optimistic, you could be Boz and say, oh, I think it's really not, that's underestimating. I think it's 15.
Okay. But, so tell me this, because Diane is heavily invested in this company now too, and she seemed to be consoling Donna. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, I made that statement before. Diane is remarkably removed from this one. She should be very, very vested and emotional and interested in the value of this. Like, oh,
that's
you guys,
what I would have
you
thought.
Guys go work it out. It's no, dude. You don't. If you invested a big chunk of your money, which she did, you are very concerned about the value of the company and the decisions being made. You don't just leave it up to people. You don't just like console one person. Because you lost a chunk, too. Your value, I mean, she's probably, if Cameron's a, whatever, 25% owner or 50%, you know, Diane's got to be 10%, 12%, whatever value was that she put in. She got equity. She got a chunk of the company.
Right. Right. I thought it was kind of odd how she was just very, how, it was almost like she worked for Donna. And I almost kind of picture it the opposite way. Like Donna works for her in a way, Donna and Cameron, you know, the company. Or at the very, very least, they work together. But it just doesn't feel that way with this
friendship. Donna works for Diane.
Right.
Every company works essentially for its shareholders. They own the company. So you work for them. It's not a line of reporting, and a day to day activity. You report to somebody on what you're doing, but you work at the pleasure of the shareholders and the board. You know, the people that own the company.
Well, right, and it's your job, so to speak, to make money for them at that point. Once you have shareholders, correct?
Right.
I mean, to advance the company and to make money for them. So I would have thought we would have seen it as much the other way. Donna talking Diane. I mean, I know Diane's got more in her life, and this is all Donna has in her life, but I just thought that was kind of an odd.
One thing Diane has more of that she seems to be using is experience, and she's mentoring Donna, and she's safer than Donna. She probably has a lot of money that she can fall back on if this falls totally flat, but Diane is going to be disappointed if this thing flops. She's not just going to be the consoling friend of Donna. That's a little bit underplayed.
Right.
But think of it this way, Michelle. If 15, they wanted to be 15, it was like, oh, we're fabulously rich. We can all get sailboats and go in colleges for our grandchildren and everybody's happy. And it's 5, it's a third. It's a third of what they thought. So if you're a multi-millionaire at 15, you're a third of that at 5. Now, if it drops to 5 cents, that's different. But we didn't see it drop to 5 cents. We saw the lowest price was 5.
Right. And also what you have to remember is they told us before that Cameron has, I think, 49%. And Donna and Gordon together have 35%. There's not a lot of percentages left to go around. And the members of the Goof Troop are looking at sailboats. So even their tiny percent, they thought they'd have the money for stuff like sailboats.
Yeah, that's believable.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. So what you're saying makes a lot of sense. Because even if you're a third of, you know, that kind of money, even for the people who don't own much stock, it's still going to be a lot of money.
Yeah.
Much
I mean,
less
20
to
million.
What Cameron
CompuServe
and Donna
valued them at 20 million. So 10% of that is 2 million. 1% of that is 200,000. So if you have one, and if you're a Goof Troop member and you have a tenth of 1%, you have $20,000. That's a lot of money for some dude at, you know, $6 an hour, or 10 bucks an hour, or whatever, making it as a coder. 20
in
grand.
In the 80s, yeah.
20 grand, boom, right in your bank account. That's a sailboat. That's easily a guy could say, wow, I'm going to spend 1,600 of that 20 grand on a sailboat. I mean, it's a lot of money to different people in different statuses of life.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's 20 million, if it's 2 million, if it's 20 million valuation and say Diane has 10%, that's $2 million. She puts in, you know, whatever she put in, 600,000, 500,000, and it goes up to 2 million. That's a nice increase for her.
It wasn't even that much, remember, because then they didn't need that much money. They just wanted to acquire swap meet. So it ended up being not even as much as they went in initially asking for to begin with.
Yeah, so, 348 yeah. or whatever. Yeah, so
that's
she's
a good point.
So she's got something at stake here. I mean, you don't want to lose 300,000, but to turn 300,000 into 2 million is a nice payday.
So Donna's reaction, this hyperventilation, were they showing us that it went lower, or is this just Donna's regret?
To regret. It's her, she failed. She's the CEO now. Everything kind of went her way. She got the IPO to happen the time she wanted, and she blew it on the TV interview, and it failed. She views herself as failing. Not that, well, I lost so much money. It's like her role. She failed at her. She stepped up to bat and struck out.
And everything she gave up, because, I mean, her and Gordon's relationship is nil from what they're showing us at this point. And the children, she missed Halloween with her children and her relationship with Cameron. And she's been kind of, you know, maybe living it up in these nice hotels, but I've never heard anybody who stayed in a hotel for very long not want to just go home, no matter how nice the hotel is. You know, you want your comforts of home. And I think she's thinking about everything she gave up and failed. And I think she may be thinking, oh my gosh, I shut Cameron out of her own business and Cameron was right. I gave up my family and everything and Cameron was right.
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty close. So next scene, Joe gets a knock on the door from the FBI. They come in and we see the port, the deck door is open, and Ryan has jumped out off the deck, killed himself.
How long did it take you to figure out what happened?
As soon as the door was open and the wind was blowing the curtains out.
Yeah, he gets a knock on the door and then he gets up and the sheets and stuff are folded, indicating that Ryan is not there and probably didn't sleep there. See, I was worried that even up to the very bitter end, the scene before this one, when he gave Ryan the sheets and everything and said sleep on the couch, I was worried Joe was going to call the FBI on him, go in his room and call the FBI. I was worried about that. So then the next morning, when he gets the knock on the door and we see the sheets folded and stuff, I didn't know. I mean, I have all this going through my mind that, okay, maybe he called them, they're there, but Ryan's already gone. And then they say, was Ryan here? We need to come in and talk. And you could hear the wind. And then you could hear in the distance a siren. And then they kind of pan to the window. And then you see this realization come up on Joe's face. And Joe realized, and like a split second later, I realized what had happened. And I was just gutted with this.
Well, the FBI or the police detective, wherever the guy was, the first guy says, you better sit down. Like, you're going to see some bad news pretty soon. But I don't, you know, I kind of knew before this that Joe offered to give him money to run away. Why would he do that and then turn him in, to decide later to turn him in?
I thought that was just to get it, just to keep him there. I did not trust Joe.
Yeah, I'll drive you to the bus station. That's like, whatever you want to do, I'll do it. I don't know. I kind of knew that,
but
he was on his side.
No, but not tonight. You need rest.
Well, yeah, he didn't say that. Well, you know now, Michelle.
I know now.
Joe and Gordon talk later. They see the note, or they talk about the note, that you are not safe. And in that note, Ryan publicly takes the blame for releasing the code, describes the internet as we know it now, pretty interesting, and how we're not safe. Gordon offers to Joe to wait until later to start their project and asks Joe, what are you going to do? And Joe says, I can't keep having this conversation. I'm done. I'm sorry. And Gordon leaves. So the next scene, we see Cameron and Tom getting ready to go to Tokyo, and she's in that preschool shirt again that she was wearing the last episode.
Yeah, I called it her traveling hobo shirt. Absolutely.
Then Cameron escapes from Tom into the world.
What was that about? Is that where you thought she was just going to leave?
Yeah, I think it's a prelude of what she really wants. She wants, I mean, there's a lot of clues here that she wants to keep away from Tom.
You know, this is the next day. This is the very next day. This is December 19th. This is the day after he told her they want to move him to Tokyo. And they're already, you know, halfway packed. And she's talking about going to the store to get things they can't get there.
Right. It's not, it doesn't make sense.
It's way too quick.
It only makes sense, like, wait a minute, I'm starting to panic and I want to move away from you, Tom, for it. If not a few minutes, maybe I never come back to you. Yeah, going to the store to find things they might not have in Japan, what the hell? What are you going to do? Pack up 50 crates of. There's a lot they don't have in Japan, I'm sure, that they have in the U.S.
And it was candy. It was candy. That's the aisle she was in.
It was an excuse. It's not really, it's not literal. She just needs space from Tom.
Yeah.
So she sees the girls and Donna at the supermarket. And this was very telling of, I guess, both Donna and Cameron. Donna's in her sweatshirt. She's not working. She's not, you know, she's like the mom again. And Cameron being close to the girls, I think, was pretty telling. And I think, Michelle, that their waves to each other, Donna and Cameron waving, I think those two waves in the flip of two quick little hands, that's 1,000 words of apology. I think that's, we're good.
Maybe it was. The way Cameron walked away.
Cameron's not a big embracer of intense moments, Michelle, in case you haven't noticed. She's an escaper.
Yeah, that's the understatement of the year. Yeah, I agree.
So she could be very, very expressively saying, I'm sorry, and I accept your apology, or I give you my apology, whatever, but I need to get out of here now because this is too intense for me, which is essentially what she does. She runs away.
Yeah.
But I think that was their being, we're good. We're, you know, whatever happened, whatever is open, anything's open to us again because we have apologized.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And we see Joe at the bridge where Ryan first tracked him down. And while we see that scene, we hear the note in his own words being read by Ryan. It's a huge danger, a gigantic risk, but it's worth it. If only we can learn to take care of each other so this awesome new creation won't isolate us. It won't leave us in the end so totally alone. Which, of course, the internet can do, can create new relationships with people across the world, and it can leave people in the same room looking at their texts on their phones totally alone from each other.
That note, that was incredible. And hearing that being read from Ryan, I mean, that was like, it really did. Now, of course, it was written with hindsight, but oh my gosh, to picture somebody with that kind of vision in that time and the things he said, it was just, I actually typed out the whole thing just so I could read it a few times. So I completely understood Joe's reading it. You know, we'll sell and be sold. We'll expose our most tender selves only to be mocked and destroyed. We'll be vulnerable and we'll pay the price. I mean, so it was just incredible.
Yeah, think of the people, the Twitter wars. People have committed suicides over being mocked by Twitter followers. You know, it has expressed, it does leave us arrows we can shoot at each other that are really harmful. Some people don't put it in the right perspective. It's super harmful. It's hurtful.
Well,
and some
right.
people probably have met on the internet and gotten married and started families. It's everything. It is all of that.
And but just that note and everything was like, so beware of false prophets that will sell you a fake future. Beware of cops and robbers, the kind that rob your dreams. I mean, just so much. It was just so much. And he talks about the massive connectivity and that the barriers are going to disappear. And then he goes, and we're not ready. And I thought that was, you know, so profound because we just saw through Donna and Cameron's company, through Mutiny, we're not ready yet for this. I don't know. I just, wow. I was just like, my mind was blown with that whole thing.
Well, even today in 2016, we may not be totally ready for all the things the internet offers us today, even. You're right. It is brilliant, though. Christopher Cantwell, Christopher Rogers, the creators of the show, showrunners, are just brilliant writers. It's interesting what they're going to try to do next, because the final two episodes are on the same night, which is interesting. There's one more night, right. One more night of two episodes. The one is that Nim 309 is Nim, the Nimrod language. I don't know how that's going to fit in, because who at this point cares about a programming language? Next seems to make more sense, 310, because that's what happened to Steve Jobs. He was forced out of Apple, started his own computer company called Next. The Next computer and the software for it are essentially the iOS platform that Apple uses today. And Jobs got so Jobs is forced out of Apple. Apple tanks. He gets hired again back by Apple, becomes the CEO, and Apple flourishes now as the most valuable company in the world. Basically under because of his guidance. And Next is the legacy of Next is the iOS iPhone and, you know, the internet software for the software for mobile devices. So Next makes sense. I can't figure out Nim, but Michelle, what do you think these guys are up? Do you think the network's going to give them a new season, or Netflix will buy them out or something?
It would be insanity for this series to not be renewed. I do hope they have like a plan, like a long-term plan and a stop date for this, because I think that's important in a series like this. But if this doesn't get renewed, it will be a tremendous oversight on some people. This is, like I said, I'm going to compare it to The Americans, and I don't compare much to The Americans.
Well, it's actually very logical that it won't be renewed, because it only gets like 280,000 viewers, whereas Walking Dead on the way other end of the spectrum gets, you know, 18 million, 20 million viewers per episode. So this on a dollars and cents level makes no sense to continue. On a creative art being very, very cool story makes a lot of sense.
I think we're seeing some more buzz about the show, though. Was it Mad Men that took a few years to really pick up? I mean, this is only the third season. I know 3 years to get this going, but this is only the third season.
Yeah, Breaking Bad, too, didn't do that well the first two seasons. But I'm afraid, I think the guys, the two Christophers, are bringing this in for a landing. I think they're getting ready for it to not be renewed.
They could have honestly ended it with this episode.
Yeah.
And I would have felt totally satisfied. If it had ended there, I would have felt just totally. I don't know what they're going to do to top this.
Well, it is a shame because they're so close. I mean, we have that future view looking back. They're so close to getting into this internet, the thing that leads us to the thing that Joe said, and maybe the very first pilot episode. It's not the computer. The computer's just the thing that brings us to the thing.
Right.
That's the internet. And they have it in their hands. They just don't know it yet.
Right.
And they're ready to walk away from it. Joe's ready to put it on hold. Gordon's not sure what to do. He needs Joe to do it. Ryan's gone. NSF doesn't even know what they have. It, you know, it's the public won't invest in it because it's too odd and quirky to be clear to them what it can do. They're so close to making it happen that if it ends in two more episodes, it's going to be, I guess it'll be interesting to think about it, but it's just almost a shame that we won't get to see it.
I agree with you.
All right, Michelle, so that's it for 308. Those next two episodes are coming up next week, Nim and Next. And I guess we'll see.
Yeah, but they gave us nothing. You know, they give us clues on what's coming up. They give us like little I mean, they're not even really clues. They're like these just little tiny nothing scenes. They gave us nothing new. Not one thing they showed us I could identify as being something new. So we have no idea. I mean, there's like nothing.
I've heard the speculation that they've given us nothing is because that there's a time jump. And if there was any indication of a next on, that you would see that time jump and you kind of know more than you should.
Well, that would definitely be my thought on it. Either that or they're just keeping it under wraps. But either way, I like that. I really like that, that we don't know. We don't know what's going to come next at all. And normally I don't like that at all, but I really liked it this time.
Well, some of the real life dates with Next Jobs' company was he started in 1988. So if it's the end of 86 here, it's a couple of years off yet. And that could be part of it. Then Apple buys out Next in 1997. Where Jobs is, so in between 88 and 97, Jobs is left out of Apple and comes back. So maybe they'll jump into the 90s with Joe being some sort of a reinvented in a new company with I don't know if I like Jobs, if I like Joe being Jobs either. So if he parallels exactly what Steve Jobs did, that might be a little heavy-handed.
I'm not even 100% sure we're talking about Joe at this point, though. Maybe we're talking about Cameron. Because it's like Jobs is almost, or Joe and Cameron are almost like a collective Jobs. Cameron was forced out. Joe wasn't forced out. I mean, he was, but he could get back in, and he won't. Cameron was forced out. I mean, it was by her own choice, but she was forced out. And then she's going and doing something else. We saw that she's created something else. And maybe she's going to be the one to come back. I don't know. But, I mean, it's just, it's a world of possibility.
Yeah, it's creative history. It's kind of based on those real-life people, but it's interesting enough that it's not exactly the same. So they could do anything with Cameron and Joe.
Right.
Cameron and Joe getting together finally and being partners, that would be a little heavy-handed, too.
Like they. Yeah, it's kind of like we talked about. I like them being drawn toward each other. I mean, if we saw like a 20-year in the future and they've got three kids, okay, I could go with that as like a very end of the end. But
Joe and Cameron having children?
Why not?
No, too heavy-handed.
Well, not showing it happen, but just showing that it did happen.
Well, I don't mean them having sex.
Well, that's not what I
No, I mean, either. Even if they were, if it's projected that they are together, that's too. I mean, they're industry peers, and they weave in and out of each other's lives. That, I think, is the interesting play with Joe and Cameron.
I agree, but I think that if the show were ending, if it were the end, and at the very end of the end, we saw that that's what had happened, and maybe we didn't see how it got there, I think that would feel satisfying to me. Because I hate to think about them living out their lives with this kind of attraction and everything, and nothing coming of that. It just like withering up and dying. And at the same time, I feel like a big jerk because I'm sitting here kind of dismissing Cameron's marriage to Tom, but I kind of am. So
yeah, that's her marriage to Tom. I've said it 100 times. Stupid.
Maybe Donna ends up with Joe. Huh.
No. Donna will end up apart from Gordon. Joe and Cameron will never get together, but Cameron and Tom will not end up staying together. And Donna, I think, is a Diane in the making. She'll be divorced from Gordon, or Gordon will pass away. She'll be kind of the single mom, successful. She'll become Diane, I think. And I think Donna and Cameron will be friends again.
Or maybe work together again.
Maybe.
Or maybe invent something great together. I don't know. I don't know. So many ways. And any way they go, they've really set this up that they can take it in almost any direction and it would make sense. I don't know how they're going to top this episode. So.
All right, Michelle, we'll find out. Any final words?
I have no final words.
What's your Twitter handle?
I am @Michelle from TN.
And I'm @ScathingTweets. So we'll see you next week on NIM and Next.
Yeah, big long one next week in the end. So I'm excited.
All right. See you, Michelle.
Okay, Mike.
I'm all lost.